Good morning. Actually, today, good afternoon. We're starting 12:30 today. Hope everybody's well. We'll start the class just in a minute. We'll continue with Kahelas. We just began chapter 4 last week. Commence with verse 1. We'll continue today. Verses 2 and 3. And we'll just maybe just review quickly what we did last week. That was 4:1. Pause intermittently throughout the classes. Any questions or comments that you want to make, if you're online, or if you just have your questions on screen if you have them. Hello, Doug.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good. Good morning to you guys. Hi, Kat. Everybody's online?
Oh, we got Jim and Rivka and Francesca and Josh.
Okay, great.
I miss anything.
Okay.
Hi, Rabbi.
Hello.
Hello, Rabbi.
Okay, so we started 4:1 last week. And Francesca, thanks for the photos, the images. I got the email. Thanks. Okay. Right, so we discussed last week.
Again, do you want questions?
Excuse me?
Do you want questions?
Yeah, I actually mentioned that. If anybody wanted to use the session today for any questions, we do that too. So if you want to stop with the questions, by all means, go ahead.
I'm trusting the questions don't have to be necessarily about Kohelet, about Kohelet.
That's right.
Okay. Rivka, did you want to ask a question?
No, it's okay. I'm listening.
Okay.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask a question.
Oh, go ahead.
About the hope. Oh, okay. So I wanted to ask about the Ayin Hara. Hold on. Hello, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Hold on. Okay, so I just wanted to ask, how does it really work? That there's supposed to be, I guess, how does it work that it says that 99% of people die from it? So I understand the concept that it's because you care about other, what other people think. I think that's what I understand, but
yeah,
the
concept of the Ayin Hara, which English means evil eye. So again, it's a very popular misnomer, but very popular, that should be qualified, amongst, you know, mystical type of thinking people that don't really look to substantiate their views in reality. Like, you know, Maimonides says, and we know ourselves. The only thing which is real is something which we experience. So if I don't experience pink flying elephants, I'm not going to say, well, maybe they could be true. I don't live my life that way. I'm not going to quit my job because maybe I'll get a job that pays 20 times as more tomorrow. When it comes down to what really concerns the person most, that's where you can really see what they really believe in. You know, they won't live their life based on horoscopes and so on. And when it comes to areas like Ayin Hara, so now since they're not risking anything by saying that the belief exists, that there's an evil eye, so they'll ascribe to it because somebody else, so many people also, and people have natural dispositions from youth that they never mature away from. The natural disposition is to be scared of monsters and to have the fear of the unknown, of the nighttime. And these things people just don't abandon, and they carry them through their adulthood because they never stop to question and to test out whether this belief is corroborated by reality or not. So, but the fact is that the rabbis do speak about the evil eye, and the one case which I always mention is where Rashi quotes the following. He says that when Jacob sent his 10 sons down because there was a famine, so he sent them down from Canaan to go to Egypt. So he said one thing to them: all 10 of you should not enter through one gate, because the evil eye shouldn't have power over you. So what does it mean? It means that just like if in Tel Aviv airport, if 10 Arabs would come through one gate, it would raise suspicion. And there's no power out there that's going to hurt those Arabs. It's the only power that exists is the human beings, that the Israeli security is suspicions, and they may trump up charges if they're not, you know, clear-thinking Israelis, and they're just, you know, vengeful, and they want to blame these 10 Arabs for all the terrorists' attacks. So Jacob said the same thing to his 10 sons. Don't invite suspicion by calling attention to yourself. Mix among the multitudes. So this way you could be covert. Get your food and leave and come back, and, you know, ascend from Egypt and come back up here to Canaan. So we have food to eat, because, again, it was a famine. So, of course, there's no power out there. It's just people's suspicion. But when a person is suspicious of somebody else, he will perhaps do things to hurt the other person. So you don't want that to happen. You don't want to invite any harm. But what you're mentioning, Nomi, is that there's also another reality, and that is a person believes something enough, they could be bothered by it to the point that they'll die. Somebody actually told me this about his daughter recently, that he said that some rabbi, because he didn't give him enough money for a blessing, so because this guy was desperate for his own daughter to have children, and she was married and she didn't have children, so he went to one of these Kabbalistic rabbis who promises these blessings and you pay, but of course it comes with a big price tag, and he paid him $100,000, and that was supposed to secure the fact that his daughter would no longer be barren. And then after months she didn't have children, so he went back to the rabbi. So the rabbi now says, no, you got to give me another 100,000, or else this time I'm going to put a curse on her that she'll never have children forever. Ended up the daughter found out about this, and she cried, because she believed it too, unfortunately, and she died because the stress got her. So that's a case where a person will believe in the curses of somebody else, and they'll really buy into it. And I remember Rabbi Chait once talking about these witch doctors. So there was one guy who was strong as an oxen, but he lived in one of these tribes, and you know, there was I guess a spell, quote unquote, was cast on him by the witch doctor, and he was going to die, and he just couldn't take the reality. It just bothered him immensely that his heart stopped. The tremendous stress. So what you believe in has a great control, you know, the mind-body connection, for sure. So that's how we understand these things. There is no power. Nobody goes to evil eye school from when they're a kid, and they can't do anything, and now all of a sudden they become an expert evil eye spellcaster. I mean, it's nonsense.
Rabbi, may I ask a question?
Yes.
I remember years ago, as a child, I remember hearing someone say that if a family, it was a very large family, and they shouldn't appear all together at one time, similar to what you mentioned about Yaakov and his sons, but they shouldn't appear all together at one time because of the evil eye, the Ayin Hara, would be it would be very bad for all the family that they would, somebody would give them an iron hara that looked with some people.
You understand how I explain it.
At this family, you say, oh, look at them, look, they have 10 children.
Right. Yeah, I know, but...
children, whatever it was at the time. And this family had no children, and that iron hara, the desire to have children and the pain of not having children somehow festered it to the point where one by one, the children died from this other family.
I don't believe the story. I don't believe the story.
No, I don't believe it either. I don't want to believe it. But
so, no.
I did hear it. So where would something like that come from? Is it similar to the thing that you said about the Indian?
No, that's a case where one person, his own internal stress hurt him. But you can't tell me that one person's internal stress is going to kill somebody else. That's why I'm saying I don't believe this story.
Uh-huh.
Right, is it?
I don't know.
It's nonsense. I mean, people believe things, and there's many, many stories out there in the world that are fables and people walking on water. It's nothing new. It's just people like these type of things, and you're not going to live by reality, so then people will believe things. And if enough people say it, they believe it too. But that's not how a clear-thinking person...
It doesn't exist.
What's that?
Why would... Let's say that this is true, what you're saying. It does not exist. It's not true. Why would somebody buy into it? Why would somebody believe it?
Very simple.
How do you...
I thought I answered that already, that it's because of people have insecurities. And they have fears from their youth that never mature away from.
Sure, that's what it was.
Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. I mean, it's... Naomi, does that answer your question?
I think so. I think what you're saying is like, the reason it kills 99% of the people, because you think about it, like, if people live until they're very, very old, like, who's going to be even jealous of them? But maybe it's just the type of thinking that stresses you out.
Yeah, it's nothing new. We know that stress hurts a person. It could ruin your digestion. It can. It says, why does it say that in the book of Exodus, it says that Joseph died and all his generation, and all his brothers, and all the generation. So why did the rabbis say, it says that Joseph died, then all his brothers. See, he died first. Why did he die first? Because he was in a position of rulership that stresses a person. So he died earlier. So when the verse puts him first, even though he was second youngest, it was because when a person's in the situation with this stress, it taxes the person physically. That's all.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
If one person in the world would hold to the theory of the evil eye, nobody else in the world would do it. I guarantee you, nobody else in the world would buy into it. It's because of the fact that it's also coupled with, you know, communities that repeat it over. And that's what it makes people feel there's truth to something when there's masses behind it. We only say that that when you have masses repeating something, the only thing that does to get proof, or it's talking about a witnessed event, not a belief. So that's why we say that if you could have millions of Christians and billions of Muslims, but the fact that what they are attesting to is not something wisdom, they are just attesting, yes, we all have this belief. We believe this happened, so we don't care how many numbers in that case. If you have, you know, a trillion people that believe in witches, that's not going to validate that as a reality. We're not going to say that witches exist now because, you know, a trillion people believe in them. We say an event took place if we have masses, because then there's no way that you would have one story and there would not be an opposing story, and it would not be, you know, it's the whole proof of Sinai. Now we accept. Doug, did you have a question to start with or no?
I do. Was there a follow-up, Naomi?
Oh, I just was going to say, I was just learning that thing. It says, I guess it says in the Gemara that the way that a man wants to go, Hashem will let him. So if the person really believes in this, I think that the books can sometimes come true.
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a verse in the Torah that says something similar to what you're saying. That it says that you shouldn't follow the sun and the moon. That God had chalak to all the nations. What does chalak mean? So one word means that he apportioned to all the nations, meaning it's not something which is specific to any one people. The sun and the moon are there for all of mankind. The chalak has another word, a meaning. Chalak also means to smooth, to make it smooth, to make it easy. Meaning that God did not put up any impediment to stop a person from following idolatry, to following the sun and the moon as their God. Meaning to say, he's not trying to mislead people. He's also not trying to impose anything on a person's free will. So it's very easy if a person wants to go that way. If he wants to follow his emotions. God that's not God's will, that a person should have a hard time following what he wants. God wants it to be easy for a person to go any way, meaning it should be his own decision and nothing else that makes his decisions in life. So maybe that's what it means. Maybe it means that in the Talmud, that the way that a person wants to go, he's led, meaning God does not put anything in front of the person's free will. Yes, somebody had a question?
Yes, you talked about experience as helping to guide our knowledge. How do we respond to somebody who claims to have experienced, like, their past lives, like through, you know, hypnotherapy, you know, and past life regression?
When I say experience, I mean on Earth, not in the imagination.
Yes, but how do we respond to them? Because I find myself hitting a wall in those discussions. Do I just drop them because that person is not rational, or is there...
You have to explain to them that what they're talking about is merely imagination. It's all it is. There's no validation for their view that whatever they're telling you over was any different than a daydream or a hallucination or something that a person wants to believe so much. And ask that very person the following. Ask them that if they imagined that in their dream, whatever this was, their past life, that they were guaranteed to have money and they wouldn't have to work, would they stop their job right now and risk foreclosure and risk their children's dying of emaciation? Ask them if they would trust their past life experience to that extent. I guarantee you will find them abandoning that view. The bottom line is, put the person to the test. How far are you willing to go? Are you willing to accept a notion to the point where you're risking your own life and your children's life? Let's say you had a vision, or you felt in your past life somebody told you could jump off of any bridge and you will not be harmed. Will you actually do it? Ask that person those questions. So then you'll be putting there what they really value most. See, what their claims are right now are inconsequential. And for whatever motivations they have the desire to believe these things, they won't believe it when it's risking their own life. And if they say, no, I won't do it, because maybe I'll die, so you can also tell them, well, listen, you'll come back again, you'll have a third life if you believe in past lives. So what are you worried about?
Yeah, but would you say that this is also similar to when somebody said that they have gone to a medium who was able to contact somebody who passed away?
Yeah, it's all lies.
They spoke to the dead.
No experience.
That doesn't spoke. This would also be in the same category, would it not?
Of course. It's all lies.
Okay.
It's belief. People can believe what they want. Who is that, Francesca?
No, this is Rivka.
No, I know, but who asked the question first?
Jim.
Naomi.
All right, does that answer your question? Is there any follow-up question?
What? No, I don't think so. I think I've been down that path, and the person then, they think that you're calling them insane, so... Since it's my father, I don't think I have anywhere to go with that.
Why? Why can't you present those questions to him?
He gets very angry.
Oh, always not willing to listen to an opinion.
Jim, would it be correct in guessing that he probably sees questions like that as an attack on him?
Yeah. Yeah, he takes it as an attack on him. He thinks I'm calling him either insane or dishonest. And he makes his living by it. He's a hypnotherapist himself, so it's that much worse.
Oh, that makes it so difficult.
Yeah, that's tough.
I have no answer.
Well, I mean, you could always talk to him and say, listen, preface the conversation by, are you open to changing your opinion if I can show you that you're incorrect? If I can give you proof that you're incorrect about something, would you be willing to change your opinion? If he says no, then you're right. Then there's nothing to talk about.
I'm sorry, does also his father making a living that way? Is it very lucrative?
Yeah, he does pretty well for himself.
That might be the other problem. Lots of crazy people out there. You can ask him, is it possible that it's not true? Is there a possibility that it may not be? Maybe he'll start thinking about it that way.
Is he a religious man at all?
He would say no. He would say he's a spiritual.
So he doesn't buy into the Bible?
Oh, no.
All right.
In fact, he thinks I'm a fool for following the path of the righteous Gentile or believing, you know, in the Jewish Bible.
And what are his reasons that he calls you foolish about that? What is his argumentation? That might be a good opening to a conversation. If he's willing to make statements about, you know, your path, so that means he's willing to talk. So you can engage him that way and then see where it goes.
Have you read any of these past life books yourself? Because some of them do advocate Christianity.
Yeah, well, they have to. They hold a Jesus second coming.
Right.
I don't know. I don't think the Christians believe in reincarnation also. I don't think so. But some of these most popular books, they do, like Glenn said, they do talk about Christianity as being true, and they prove it from past lives. So if he doesn't believe in religion, I mean, it's like one way to say like that.
But there's also another point, Jim. That is that even if he wants to say, oh, you're just trying to attack me, you could say, all right, fine, I'm attacking you. You want to view it as an attack, I have no problem, I'll accept the blame of an attack, but please answer my question. An attack doesn't mean that you're making a statement that's false. So you may be able to get around that line of defense by saying, all right, you want to say I'm attacking you, fine. That's not my point over here. My point is that will you take your belief to the point where you would now, if you had one of these visions, and it means you're not going to work anymore, and you can jump off a bridge or whatever these things, would you take it that far? And if you see that, of course he's not going to be able to answer, he's not going to be able to say, yes, I would.
I think the rabbi is right. I think that would be the key.
So, I mean,
he would have nowhere to go.
Yeah, don't stop.
To answer you.
Yeah. I wouldn't stop because somebody says you're attacking me. All right. So it's an attack. You can still ask my question. I don't feel I'm attacking you. I'm being respectful. But if you want to call it an attack, I'll accept the blame. But why can't you answer the question? All right. See what happens. I mean, you know, you have to look for opportunities if you really want to help out your father. And maybe even talk to us. Let's have a man-to-man talk. That's it.
Well, I have to be particularly delicate because for 2 years he didn't talk to me. Because I did this sort of in a blog, and he felt embarrassed. And
yeah, that wasn't a good move.
That was not then told him I hadn't honored him very well, but now I have to be especially delicate when the topic comes up.
Right.
So then you can be delicate. You can do it one-to-one. No one has to be around. No one has to know. You can just talk to him one-to-one, man-to-man.
That's true, but the underlying anger is still there. It makes it difficult. You're not having a conversation between two rational people about a rational topic. You're having a conversation that makes one of them very angry.
I think a key is
where it's very difficult, like your situation, and if you preface the conversation with, you say to the person, you know I love you very much, and I respect you very much, but I don't understand this, and somehow it just doesn't add up. Like two and two adds up to four, this doesn't add up to me. If you could preface it with good feelings first, and say how much you care, then maybe you could set the way for him listening to the rest of what you have to say. He has to acknowledge first that he does not, in other words, you want to be sure that he doesn't feel that he's going to be attacked right away, because he has this feeling that if you will speak with him possibly, that you're open to attacking him. But no, if you preface it with, I love you and I respect you and I honor you and whatever else you can think of that would make sense to him and that would soften him. The whole thing is you want to soften him and bring him down from the attack level. Because he's ready, he's already got his boxing gloves on. And you want to remove that before you start any other conversation. My humble opinion.
Jim, Jim, my experience too has been if somebody's really set in those kinds of ways, then it's very difficult to chat with them if they're not open to hearing an idea. And in fact, it can potentially be counterproductive if you're trying to force something on him that he simply doesn't want to hear or is unwilling to hear. You know, if we took it out of this context and I were just talking about trying to speak to a person of a different religious belief who was absolutely convinced their religious belief was right and they were unwilling to look at something else, I would probably be wasting my time, because if they're not open to hearing an idea, they're not open to hearing an idea. And so, I mean, you kind of have to weigh that depending on their relationship and all the dynamics that go on there. It may be one of those situations where you simply can't can't talk about the subject.
Thank you, everybody.
Okay. Doug, you had...
Is there a phenomenon, at least with some parents, that it's... especially hard to be corrected by their own child, perhaps?
Yeah, I'm sure that exists.
There's at least his family in general, even his own father. He has a very... Yes, there's that piece of it, yes.
Right, yeah, I guess...
I don't know, I feel like sometimes it's a little bit... on the child side, it seems like almost, is it really my place to try to correct the parent? It should be the other way around, you know what I mean?
Right.
It could be kind of difficult on both sides with the relationship there.
That's part of the problem, because he's not letting his son grow up to the point where he can have his own opinions and voice them without feeling attacked. He wants to make that very clear to his son, I think, that he knows because he's the father, and the son couldn't possibly know because he's the son. So he's not letting the son grow up, in a sense, I think. My humble opinion. That makes it so difficult.
All right, I think
we exhausted it. Let's see how it pans out when you have the opportunity to speak to your father again. Doug, you had the question to start out. Let's move on so we can give some more time to other people's questions.
Yeah, the question I had was, we've talked about prayer in the past, and that prayer elevates you, or can, to a higher level by going over and over correct ideas about God, and that puts you potentially at a higher level of knowledge and understanding so that God can relate to you differently. So what then, I mean, I understand for Jewish people that halakha requires them to pray, but there is no halakhic requirement for Noahites to pray, except, I understand, in times of danger. So what would be the difference then between spending 15 minutes in prayer versus spending 15 minutes in some area of Torah learning where you're being exposed to some ideas that will hopefully raise you to a higher level?
Well, the answer is that the formulation that the rabbi has made of prayer guide a person's thoughts down a certain specific path. For example, Rabbi Chaid explained the first one of the prayers is talking about that God was the shield of Abraham, and that he had providence over Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So it talks about individual providence. The next prayer moves on to that God is powerful just in terms of natural law. And he causes the wind to blow and the rain to fall. Let me just see, how does that one conclude? That's called Gevuros, that is power. Right. So that's, and it, one second. Here, let me just get a sitter. Hold on. It ends off with the God resuscitates, resurrects the dead. And the third prayer ends off with that God is completely unknowable. So you first talk about God personally, that he had specific providence over individuals, personalities, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Then you moved on more to his power, not over specific individuals, but a general providence over man. And then finally we say that God is unknowable. So we're moving away progressively from the personal, our interest in the personal, to more of an objective view of God. So to answer your question, what would the difference be? The difference is that there's a specific mode of thinking that the rabbis are trying to instill in a person three times a day when they pray. So that would be the benefit that you're gaining if you follow the prayer as opposed to just sitting down and learning. Because then in terms of prayer, that's effective in terms of relating to God on a more, in a truer sense. A person relates to God just because he has personal needs, as opposed to relating to God that he understands that God is this unknowable being, and he's making more statements, and he says, well, God is completely unknowable to us. So that's a higher level relationship to God, believe it or not, when you make statements that we're relating to God just vis-a-vis him alone, not vis-a-vis his relationship to us, because God's greatness is not dependent on his relationship to man. He had his greatness before man existed. So if we talk about God in terms of his own greatness, that's more of an accurate, and it's a more, we're related to God more properly. So that could help out in terms of how that God's going to relate to a person more when he's on a higher level of intelligence. You see?
I think so.
Yes, yeah, like if a person goes over to a wall and he asks the wall to give him money, what's going to happen? Person goes to God, so then the ability is there. Now he's approaching the right being. The first thing was not a being to begin with, so the whole approach was completely wrong. I'm just giving you a very stark analogy. You know, the contrast, you always see a point better when the contrast is the greatest. So what we're doing in prayer is, in those first couple of prayers, is moving away from the person, because the person during the day, he gets absorbed in the self and making a living. So he's really centered around the self to a great degree. In order that he's praying properly, he should be relating to God vis-a-vis God alone. Well, how great is God? Let me recognize, the first thing I say in the morning when I wake up, we say, after Moda Ani, but the first prayer is, blessed is the one who spoke and the world came into being. Not blessed is the one who is giving me money in my pocket every day. Then you're bringing God back down now to his praise, to a very small thing and a personal thing, when really his greatness is that he's a creator. So when you're relating to God properly, then you're bringing yourself under his providence more. That's Maimonides' example, that he says that God doesn't change. It's man that changes. And through the change, so the closer, let's say you bring an object to the fire. So when something is far away from the fire, it's in darkness. You bring it closer, it becomes illuminated. You bring it closer, it becomes warm. You bring it into the fire, it could change the shape of the object. In all four cases, the fire did not change. It was the proximity of the object to the fire. So the analogy my mind uses, same thing with man. The closer he is to God, so the more he's going to be under God's providence. And that means closer in terms of having the right knowledge of God and worshiping him properly. And like Rabbi Chait said, you know, the service of God is really the service of the self. Meaning you're doing yourself a good when you serve. You're doing nothing to affect God. God has no needs from anything. So all these ideas are necessary. And of course, prayer also has an order. The first thing we ask for in the request portion is knowledge. So the rabbis also very wisely organized the order of what those 19 benedictions are, those intermediary, the request portion. So, but again, this is one of the things, you know, that you can take on and benefit from it. That's not one of the things that's off limits to Noahan. There's just certain words that have to be changed, that's all. Because, you know, if you're not like a descendant of Abraham, so then you wouldn't be able to say that. You know, things like that. But I think there's very few changes.
So, what would be the difference between sitting down at your study desk with a siddur and walking through the ideas and thinking about them, kind of like study of material, versus standing up and saying them as in a prayer?
Because in a prayer, then you're recognizing there's a dialogue that's available between you and God. And you are requesting. That's the main part of the prayer, is you're asking for your needs. And in that dialogue is an admission that you know that God listens and he can respond. If you're sitting and studying, you're not making that demonstration, right? The dialogue is absent.
And when you say dialogue, I mean, there's no voice that comes back, so...
It's true. But
what's God's part of the dialogue?
Well, let's put it this way. It's not a monologue. Let's put it that way. It's not, you know, you alone that's engaged in the activity. This is a case of a dialogue where there's a speaker and there's a listener. And the response doesn't have to be verbal either. God's response does not have to be verbal.
I'm sorry, God's response what?
Does not have to be verbal.
Oh, okay.
You know, you're praying for things and things can go into the works. And if you organize your life in a way where you're trying to reach him, of course he's going to respond and give you those things that are necessary. I mean, that's what the Torah's view on this, and it makes sense clearly that a person wants to live the life of study, because study is the greatest command, and he wants to be involved in seeing the wisdom. That's why God gave us intellect, and he gave nothing else intellect, so that means that we are supposed to use the intellect. That's the real objective. So if we want to live that life, and we want to have minimal distractions, and we understand we have to work, God will give a person it's Maimonides, let me read it to you. Because this applies to Noahide. One thing.
This is in Maimonides' Laws. It's in the section of Zeroyim, right? Yeah. In the Mishnah Torah, the two volumes, at least, it's the first part. And the very end of his laws of Shemitah and the Jubilee. Shemitah is the seventh year cycle where they let the land rest. So his very last statement in all of those laws, he has a very important statement. He says, he's talking about the Shevet Levi, the tribe of Levi. Yes, this is chapter 13, laws 12 and 13. So it's laws of the Shemitah and the Jubilee, Shemitah and Yovel, 13, 12, and 13, 13. So 13, 12 reads as follows. He says, why wasn't the tribe of Levi included in the inheritance of the land of Israel? Because they are separated to worship God and to serve him and to teach his ways that are upright and his statutes that are righteous to the masses. As it says, they will teach his statutes to Jacob and his Torah to Israel. Therefore, they were set aside from the rest of the normal manner of the world, and they don't go to war like the rest of the Israelites do, and they do not inherit land, and they don't merit anything by the work of their hands. They are the army of God. As it says, God blessed his army, and God, blessed be he, merits them. And he says, I am their portion, and I am their inheritance. That means God takes care of their sustenance. And you see that we have commands to give to the priests and to the Levites. They're all one tribe. We have to give them gifts. But look what he says next. He says, not only the tribe of Levi alone it will merit to have God's providence, but any man, he does not say any Jew. He says, any man, anybody who enters the world, right? It means man and woman. Anybody whose heart moves him and he dedicates his heart and he understands from his own knowledge to separate himself to stand before God and to worship him and to do his service. And what is that? To know God means study. And then he says also to go upright as God had made him. And what will happen if a person lives this way, any person, man or woman, Jew or non-Jew, it says the following, Maimonides says, God will remove, he will uncuff the yoke of calculations and monetary needs that the rest of the masses follow and that they seek out. Because this person is holy of holies, and God will be his portion and his inheritance forever and always. And he will merit in this world sustenance that is sufficient to him. Very important. He's not looking for wealth. He's not looking to die rich. He's just looking that he has his food, he has his shelter, he has his clothing. That is all he wants in terms of material. The rest of his energies he devotes to learning, to teaching. So then if this is the life he wants to live, as God had made him, so then God will remove all the calculations and the money needs that the rest of the world has. And God will provide to this person a sufficient livelihood. Just like God merited to the Kohanim, the priests, and the Levites. As King David said, peace be upon him, God is my portion and my lot. And he is my goblet, my kosi, and my cup. You've perfected my lot.
Rabbi, the last statement you said, he will merit in this world sustenance that is sufficient for him. Was that the word?
Exactly.
Okay.
Meaning, a person's living the right life. You have Maimonides, you know, one of the greatest thinkers. He's telling you that. I mean, his knowledge and what he wrote. You see, he had one of the most broadest grasps on all of what the Torah is about. You know, themes and fundamentals, and categorically knowing what is primary in Torah. And he makes a statement like this: that any person, man or woman, that comes to the world and wants to separate themselves out to serve God, and that means what? To know him and to be upright before him. That means that you seek
knowledge on a regular basis, and you apply that knowledge. That's what it means to be upright, is that your actions follow through. You live by virtue. So then God will make sure that that person has what is sufficient for him. He's not going to have to worry. Because that is the whole purpose we're here. Now, why did I bring that up? I forgot what I was trying to bring a point to somebody. All right.
You were talking about prayer. And the difference between simply reviewing the prayer versus putting your request before God.
All right. The dialogue. So the dialogue is not verbal.
Dialogue.
That the response, and you see here, here's the guarantee to the response that Maimonides is talking about. So a person should have that confidence. He should have that realization. There's never a reason for a person to be desperate. The rabbis even say that even if the sword is at your neck, meaning even if you're in the most perilous, most risky situation, of course, you don't put yourself there, but sometimes a person finds himself in a very, precarious situation. So he says, even at that point, never give up on God's mercy. God can come in and change things in a split second. The rabbis also say that the salvation of God is as fast as the wink of an eye.
Right.
So there's no grounds ever for desperation.
Rabbi, could I ask a question in reference to this, please?
Yes.
Three times a day, generally, that man prays to God. But isn't it true that even if he feels the need, he could pray between those times and still feel the connection?
Yeah, he has to include something new.
He doesn't have to have the Siddur in his hand all the time when he's praying.
Well, he has to have the right formulation.
In his mind, he could just call to God and ask for help. If there's, like you mentioned, a precarious situation, a perilous situation, it doesn't have to be necessarily with the prayer book in his hand. He could still have that connection.
Well, he should pray. There is an abridged version if a person is in the situation where he can't say the entire Shmon Esrei, the whole one, because that could take, 5-10 minutes to say. So there is an abridged version that a person is allowed to say. But a person should
well,
use...
I didn't mean not to say the three times. I mean,
no, I'm saying that he has to use the right formulation. He has to use the formulation of the rabbis.
He wants to call to God in between those times. He could still feel that connection.
No.
Without the figure in his hand.
No, a person is supposed to use the right formulation, not just to make up his own words. There's a formulation of prayer for a reason.
Okay.
Where do we find the that shortened version?
Good question. I'm not sure what Siddurs have it. It's called Havi Neinu. Havi Neinu is the... It basically takes a little bit from each one of the 19 prayers. It could be... probably the Mishnah Brura has it in the Laws of Prayer. Does it answer your question, Doug?
Yeah. Could you say it? Havi Neinu?
Havi Neinu. Havi Neinu.
H-A-V-I-M-A-I-N-U?
N like Nancy. Havi Neinu.
Got it. Okay. I can probably look that up. It's probably on the net somewhere.
All right, do we have other questions?
Yes, Rabbi.
Go ahead.
I was wondering if you could give a recommended reading list.
For what?
For a new Noahide. I've gotten... I don't know exactly what's permitted and what's forbidden, and I don't want to overstep my bounds when I'm buying books, I guess is really what I'm worried of mostly. I got Duties of the Heart, and I got On Belief and Opinion. I got Art Scroll Homush and a copy of Rashi coming, and I'm wondering what I can, I'm permitted to read and you would recommend for reading as a Noahide, and then what I guess I'm not permitted to read.
I think Doug would be able to answer that better in terms of, because he's been following this path for many, many years, and I've only been teaching it for a few years. So I would defer to Doug to answer that.
Jim, Duties of the Heart is probably the number one book after the Torah. The commentary of Rashi is excellent. The Nachmanides, the Ramban with an N at the end, has a commentary on the Torah, which is excellent, and it's available in English. In fact, Art Scroll, I haven't looked at theirs, but they are just doing one now. And so that's worth getting. There's a commentary on the Torah by the Sforno that's available in one volume in English. I think it's either Feldheim or Art Scroll. Might be Feldheim publishes that. In terms of generally what you are allowed to study versus not study, the general rule that I understand is you're not allowed to study something that would never apply to you. So, for example, the details of the specific laws around the sacrifices that the high priest would make in the temple. That's never an area that would devolve upon me, and so I'm not allowed to get into a study of it. But there's so much in the Torah that is, because in order to study, or in order to understand the Torah, you have to understand basic foundational ideas and all the things that are in the Torah that have to do with character development and so forth are all things that a Noahide can be involved in. So I've rarely run into a situation that I've had to step away from. If I'm reading something and they're getting, but I don't think it's like a taboo thing where, oops, I'm not supposed to read this, I better look away kind of thing. I think it's more like an intention to study an area that has no application for me. If I were reading along in the Stone edition of the Humish, for example, with its commentary, and I ran into something where we were talking about the, you know, specific stuff for the priest, I wouldn't suddenly feel like, oh, wait, I've got to stop reading. But it would be more a case of if I delve into a particular area that doesn't apply to me specifically for the purpose of studying that, or of turning around and teaching others or something like that. That is my understanding of what's prohibited. I was in a situation once where I was in a yeshiva and was just learning with some yeshiva guys because I wanted to understand the methodology, and they happened to be studying one of those esoteric areas that didn't apply to a Noahide. And at first we stopped because we didn't think that was appropriate. And Rabbi Chait later indicated that it was, as long as we were doing it for the purpose of understanding the method and not the content, that was okay. So I think there's a fair amount of flexibility. It's just you don't want to dive into something that clearly doesn't apply to a Ben Noah. Does that help?
Okay. Yes, that helps a lot. I've got Ethics of the Fathers. That should be fine, right?
Ethics of the Fathers is great. Yes. That's
good.
An excellent one. I would have added to that list. And I don't have my office bookshelf right in front of me. But those are the main ones. Duties of the Heart, again, being kind of the first one after the Torah itself.
I mean, I would say also
anything that you want to add to that, you're welcome.
I mean, the Guide for Perplexed also very important.
could make a suggestion too. I don't think you mentioned some of the like Lockic sources on the seven laws would probably be good, like the Laws of Kings and maybe Tractate Sanhedrin.
Right, that's good too.
Yeah,
it has a lot of application. And Tractate Avodah Zarah too, where it talks about all the ideas about Noahide. Clearly all the stories about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob who were Noahides, so to understand their perfection is certainly obligatory, not just permitted. I would say that's like really to understand, you know, the primary Noahides. All right, so maybe we'll wrap it up over here. I just have to get going into the city, so it was good discussion today. Good discussion. Again, if there's any follow-up questions, you know, definitely email, you know, throughout the week, as normally. All right.
All right. Thank you, Rabbi. I appreciate it very much.
Okay. I hope everybody enjoys the day off.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi.
My pleasure.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.